Blog Talk Radio.
Art Bell has gone to bed. Rush Limbaugh won't be awake for hours. You have arrived at the Commute Faster Energy Hour. Energy. There comes a time when all good men come to realize that that disturbing hacking cough is not caused from years of smoking because they never smoked a day in their life. No, we can thank big oil, coal, and nuclear waste for polluting the air we breathe and the water we drink. But now, bringing solutions to the monopoly-caused energy crisis, and coming to you from his remote location in exile, deep in a salt mine just outside Death Valley, kind of living out my own near-death experience, I'm your energy expert and host, Ken Rasmussen, occasionally called Late Night Leroy. Alternative energy fans. My name is Ken Rasmussen. I'm the host of the Commute Faster Energy Hour, and I'm occasionally known as Late Night Leroy, and that's based on a web column I used to write for another website. I welcome you first-time listeners here, and we're all first-time listeners because I'm a first-time host on this show. We are trying to get news about alternative energy out to the public in general. And we'll on this first show, we'll lay some ground rules here so that we can get an idea what direction we want to take the program. Since it is entirely web-based, I'll simply draw your attention to the host page, which has the call-in number there. So if you have any questions for the host or the guest, as we have various guests on the program, you're welcome to call in. We're not going to be dealing with anything controversial today, so we probably won't have any callers, and not many people know about the existence of the show right now. You're probably listening to this in archive. So for future shows, just check the website for the call-in number. The program is based around my energy page, which is one of the subpages from commutefaster.com. That's C-O-M-M-U-T-E-F-A-S-T-E-R, just like your daily commute, but you want to commutefaster.com. And once you get to the front page there in the top right corner, you'll see a purple button that says energy. And if you click on that and scroll through the page, that's generally the topics that we talk about here, is the problems we have with the current energy program in this country and really around the world that's really way too dependent on oil and nuclear. And we are endeavoring to show solutions to this issue on how to get away from this addiction with oil. There's been plenty of political rhetoric about the topic, but very little has been done. And we're trying to make a difference with this program. Again, let me get some ground rules set up here. And these are just some comments off the top of my head from listening to other talk shows. And I should point out that I listen to a lot of talk shows on a variety of topic, and that's pretty much my my School of Hard Knocks degree is talk show listening. And a common problem with many talk shows is callers who aren't really paying attention, and they call in with an off-topic question, and it just kind of generally interrupts the conversation, and it's not good for the listeners, and it destroys the train of thought for both the host and the guest. So my comment on that is God gave us two ears and one mouth, so please pay attention to the direction that the conversation is going on the talk show and call in with an appropriate question. This show is supposed to be informative, educational, and you're supposed to finish the show at the end a better person than you were when you started, based on the information that we go over. So if you do call in for a question, it would be nice if it's a question you think that a lot of other people are asking as they listen to the show, and feel free to speak for the many in your camp who have that question. Call in, toss it at the guest, and we'll try to get you an answer for it. Initially on this show, I'm going to give you a monologue here for about the first half hour, just to set the premise of what direction we're going to go in. In the second half hour of the program, I have a special guest coming on who is a specialist in one realm of alternative energy, and that would be the concept of running a car on water. I was on another talk show not long ago, and I brought up that topic, and one of the networks that was taking that show said, "This guy is an idiot, nobody's ever run a car on water," and they actually cut that radio show's feed. So believe it or not, just talking about a mundane topic about even the theoretical capability of running a car on water actually gets some people so bent out of shape that one radio talk show's feed was actually cut off a network, and they played music the rest of the hour, as absurd as that is. Well, thank God for Blog Talk Radio. There is no censorship here. I'm welcome to go any direction I want. And so I'm going to try to do the best I can to get the truth on alternative energy out to the public here, both in its technical feasibility, and then we'll go into the economics issues, and then we may have to touch on religion and politics. Now, today is the first show, and we are doing this, the live recording, I should mention, is started at 1 o'clock Pacific time on February 15, 2007, just so we can log in the date on this program. I'm not sure what time of day we will be doing future shows, and I'm not even sure how many we'll be doing a week. My initial plans are to do three shows a week. Two will be technical, going into the technical and maybe economic feasibilities of various technologies. But the third is how I want to handle the off-topic questions that frequently come in, and that's when religion and politics come up. If anyone thinks that alternative energy is just a simple case of, well, Detroit's just not giving us the products that run on alternative energy, and if we want to blame Detroit on it and think that religion and politics has nothing to do with it, well, I'm sorry, your head is in the sand. You've never dealt with the complexities of bringing a new technology to market and know what's involved. And I'm sorry to say religion and politics is a key factor in that. Now, since most people don't want to hear that topic when they tune in to listen about alternative energy, fine, we will shift that to the third show of the week. So if I can follow my initial format here of Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, say, and like I say, this may change, I may change it to a weekend show, but we will have one program out of the week that is dedicated solely to religion and politics issues, just to find out if that has anything to do with why we can't see water cars running down the road. So today we are, even though this is a Thursday, we are going to take the safe approach and simply look at the historical aspect of what inventors have actually accomplished in the past. Not so much what's available today, but what inventors have accomplished in the past, which may be a surprise to most people who hear this for the first time. Generally speaking, you only hear the idea of running a car on water on comedy shows. And it's usually commented very flippantly. What a recent movie, Syriana, had a comment in there on showing how powerful the oil industry was. And this high-powered attorney makes the comment that, well, as long as nobody runs cars on water, we're fine. Well, it's actually been done. It's been done by a handful of people, and our guests on the next part of the show is going to be going into that and actually giving names of people who have accomplished it. Most of them, unfortunately, are no longer with us, passed away for a variety of reasons. And when we want to get into again, religion, politics, and conspiracy topics, then we'll deal with that on the third issue. So we're going to avoid the conspiracy stories since I'm sorry to say half the public at large is a participant in the criminal actions. If you stop and think where you spend your money on a daily basis, is that really contributing to a good cause, or is somebody else taking the money and doing something sinister with it? That question can be raised with not only your daily shopping, but where your income taxes go, where your sales and property taxes go. Have you completely lost control of your money after it leaves your pocket and your checking account? Well, to an extent you have. We live in a somewhat free country here in the United States, and we do have some say in the matter. But again, I'm getting off topic right now. Where are we going to go on the technologies? We will be discussing just about any new feasible technology that's out there. I have two favorites myself. I like the idea of the water car. I'll come back to that in a second. And the other technology I like is permanent magnet motors. The concept on a permanent magnet motor is if you arrange like a stack of donuts in a circle and aim your polarity in the right direction and then have a wheel on the inside of the circle with the same polarity opposing, that you can simply draw energy out of that. There are many skeptics out there who say, oh, that's just perpetual motion. Well, no, it's not perpetual motion, guys. It's a new machine with a new energy source. And there's plenty of debates on that. So we'll be getting into the pros and cons, and we'll give answers to the skeptics as we get into these various technologies. Now, getting back to the water car. Technically, nobody runs a car on water. Water does not burn. You have to break the water down into its components, components being hydrogen and oxygen. The methods taught in elementary, junior high, and high school, and on through college teach that conventional electrolysis devours a way more current, way more energy than you get when you turn around and burn the hydrogen. That is a debatable issue, and we will be going into that as we delve into to that realm. But the term running a car on water, 99 times out of 100, is in reference to a more specific technology, and this is one of the few acronyms we're all going to have to learn, and that's HOD, which stands for hydrogen on demand. And what that refers to is that you only carry water with you, but you have some form of an electronic or chemical or metallurgic device that quickly, conveniently, and most of all, efficiently breaks your water down into the component gases that you need for fuel. Now, once you have the hydrogen, you can use that either in the latest design is hydrogen fuel cells. Those have their advantages and disadvantages, which we'll be going into in future shows. Or the regular engine that you've got in your car sitting in the driveway today could actually run on hydrogen with somewhat of an easy modification. So hydrogen is simply a combustible gas, which is what gasoline fumes are. So it's just a matter of modifying your fuel to air ratio, which a good competent mechanic can do. And just a few other minor things will make any engine, any internal combustion engine that's out there now, run on hydrogen gas. So the theoretical goal of the general term water car fans, or the more specific technology, the general goal of hydrogen on demand experimenters and researchers, is to try to find a convenient method, a feasible working method that will quickly electrolyze water into its component gases, then feed those gases right into your engine, and voila, there's your power, and you're going down the road powered from the initial source of water, but with the necessary fancy electrolysis device in between. So it would be a water-powered car that utilizes the elaborate electrolysis device in between that makes this all feasible. So what our guest will be going into is the few people that have actually accomplished that in history. I'm sorry to say we don't have, well, I won't say we don't have anybody alive doing it today, because I don't know what all has been accomplished in the garages and backroom research labs around the country. And for that matter, if you've read my energy page, you know, give out that website once again. It's commutefaster.com. Go to the top right corner, look for the purple button, and click on energy, and then just read the news stories of the day. And as I'm doing with the talk show, where I want to have technical shows, and then I'll have kind of an open forum to cover whatever political aspects are related to it on a separate show. What I want to do, or what I have done with my website, is everything is categorized. I have, as you scroll down on the page and you get to news and documentation, and maybe I should take a quick look at my page here. I call it announcements, news, and documentation. I have all my stories categorized. So depending on what your interests are, choose whichever column you want to read. If you hate religion and politics, then stay out of columns 1 and 2. Just ignore them completely and go directly to technological advances and products available now. If you're very prone to studying what political aspects are causing the shortage of these problems, then please read columns 1 and 2. Columns 1 and 2, as I title 1, is known problems, and that's not always religion and politics. That is any existing problem we've got. And it could be a physical limitation, that maybe this is a technology we don't have any way to penetrate through. And so I'll hit on news-related topics in column 1. Column 2 is directly about politics, and it's not just politics in the United States. It can be government actions in any country that are related to energy. And then column 3 is that's the important column that we all got to read here, and that's the technological advances. That's the latest news that I hear about good stuff out there. So that it's column 3 is generally the latest news. Now, I should back up a little bit. I only have the time, since it's a one-man show here, I only have the time to update my energy page a couple of three times a week. So my page is not really the place you go for the latest and greatest in headlines. But as you arrive on the energy page, over in the right column, you'll see several links to several other sites, and those guys have got bigger budgets than I do. They usually have a team of reporters working with them. And those are the sites that will really have the daily news. I have to highly recommend Free Energy News. It's run by a good friend of mine, Sterling Allen. KeeleyNet is excellent. Topics, just going down the list, there are several good sites there. And then into the smaller text, you'll see some links to even government sites on various energy issues. And then one other thing I'll even comment there. You'll see I have a link over to Space Weather. That has to do with energies that we have no control over whatsoever, outside of prayer, is what is the sun doing today? And on the also very controversial topic of global warming, is it caused by man or is it caused by nature? Well, the best minds that I follow say that we see global weather issues are changing, but it really has to do with the solar flare activity of the sun. It is acting completely out of whack. It's not following its typical cycles, and we've had some major flares in the last few years that are no doubt charging and discharging the Earth's magnetic field and just creating havoc in the upper atmosphere, which redirects the jet stream and gives us all this bizarre weather we get all around the planet. So if you wonder what the sun is doing today, on my energy page, you'll see two pictures of the sun there. One is structured to show a four-day time lapse of the last sunspot activity, and that's kind of the orange dot there on the page. The red dot on the page, the red square there, it shows the solar flare activity. And it's when we get those big solar flares that you count off about 10 to 15 days, and for some strange reason, we get big 6, 7, 8-point earthquakes around the globe. And that's been studied by several wiser researchers than me, so that's not just a rumor. But that's why I have those links there, is to realize just what massive amount of energy is all around us that we haven't even tapped into yet. So that's just a brief summary on the Commute Faster Energy page, and I encourage everybody to check that page out frequently. And if I don't happen to have any current news stories posted on my page, then just scroll back up to the top right of the page and take a look at the other energy sites that I have links to there, and you may find something that's a brand new story that I haven't had the time to post yet myself. And I will try to keep at the top of the page a link over to the Blog Talk Radio show, and eventually we'll have a link that will enable to play whatever the last show was. If you weren't able to hear it live, these shows are archived, and they should be archived and posted at that at the same page you come to hear the show. The archives will be posted there, and they show up about within an hour or two after the program ends. So that would be it. Let's see, I've got 22 minutes after the hour at this point, and we should be getting our guest in about another 8 minutes, or whenever he shows up on my host control panel here. If my guest James is listening, feel free to call in any time, and we might bring you on a few minutes early here and give you a little more airtime so people don't have to endure my own ramblings. So just reviewing some of the basics here that I want to follow on future shows so that I can refer people back to this one for basic guidelines is, when you call in, please show respect. Please show the same respect that you want me to show you. And we just act as civilly as we can here. And I'm an unashamed born-again Christian, and I was just raised up to do unto others as I want them to do unto me. So I will try to be polite to you, and I just request the same respect as you toss questions back at me. Now, my opening music, I refer to myself as a energy expert, and I use that term very loosely. My own energy credentials are simply from my own hobby. Maybe I should tell a little bit about myself. I'm 55 years old right now, so I've been through several careers in my life. I did sound and such in Hollywood for a while. And if you think, boy, he must have been a terrible sound man the way the show sounds, well, I am limited by the way this automated network is and what sound sounds like coming over a telephone, so I really don't have a studio to produce this from, I'm sorry to say. So I'm limited by the new realm of digital switching is what controls this. But besides that, I worked about 11 years in aerospace and had an extensive background in metals and advanced composites, so that's pretty much my technical background. And then after leaving aerospace, I worked in the securities industry, the financial realm, for about 6 years, and for those 6 years, I worked with a company that specialized in doing IPOs for new startup companies. Now, where that experience comes directly into relevance now with my focused interest on alternative energy is, few people know how extremely difficult it is to get a new business out there. Just inventing a good idea and making it work is like 10% of the process. The next thing is, how are you going to make it available for people to buy it? And let's face it, everybody shops at Walmart and Kmart anymore. So if it's not on the shelf at Walmart or Kmart, or if I can't get a part for my car at AutoZone, then who's going to know that your idea exists? And that is no easy task. There is a tremendous amount of capital necessary for that. You don't build a factory for a few thousand dollars. You don't build a factory for a few hundred thousand dollars. If you have to have payroll for a couple of hundred people to assemble things, you're talking literally millions of dollars. That is not readily available from somebody's private bank account who just invented something. And my own knowledge of history is that necessity is the mother of invention. And the people that come up with these brilliant ideas, a large percentage of them are unemployed. They just got the shaft from a job they worked at for many years, and something went wrong. The job got outsourced overseas. Technology axed them, whatever the reason was. We've got some well-meaning, very, very moral people that sit back and say, all right, I want to make lemonade out of this lemon. I've got a slow point in my life. I can't find another job in my specialized skill, so I'm going to sit down here and invent something. Well, these are the people that come up with the brilliant ideas on how to do it. But now what have you got? You've got a brilliant person who made something that does something fantabulous, but he doesn't have a dime to his name. He's in hock over his head, running his credit cards up just to try to save the mortgage on his house, and he doesn't have the money to go out and start a factory. So these are the realities of life that we'll be going into here. And this brings up kind of a sour point that I've seen on energy chat boards way too often, is the frivolous use of the word scam. And just because they can't buy this new idea on the shelves at Walmart, then this inventor must be a scam artist. He's just taking money from me and he can't deliver such a thing. That's a bunch of hogwash. The troubles new inventors have to go through to, number one, build a prototype that might be quite expensive to build because of the necessary machining and technical materials and whatnot that go into it. Or maybe it's a mathematical challenge and he has to buy the latest version of AutoCAD to solve how to get something bent around a corner. These expenses are not cheap, and new inventors are the first people to know that. And for a skeptic out there to sit back and say, oh, he's just taking my money, well, most inventors don't know how to obtain capital. That's one thing I definitely learned as a stockbroker. You can't go public with a new company at the drop of a hat. The last I looked to take a company public, that's a couple hundred thousand dollars, which you better come up with somewhere or it ain't going to happen. You don't just click a few links on an internet website and voila, you have a public company. No, your company's got to get has to have books established, has to do cost projections, has to go through a securities firm, a registered securities firm, licensed people, have to then blue sky your company in all 50 states, and then if you're very low capitalized, then the best shot you're going to get is you're going to get listed on the pink sheets, which means nobody's going to find you, and you're right in there with all the other penny stocks, of which many of them are just simply flaky companies. And now you're in amongst a bunch of other flakes, and what are they going to start calling you? So just the fact that you even have a public stock company does not solve everything. Public relations and everything comes into the issue, and so now even if you've designed your factory and managed to somehow come up with $200,000 to get yourself a public company, how in the world are you going to cover the advertising costs? Look at television ad time. People only seem to learn things from television anymore. It's only the intelligent people that get on the internet, like hopefully my listeners here, and search out talk shows that cover something intelligent. But by and large, the public that you're going to have to mass market to, because they're the mass of the wave that swings the money, you're going to have to come up with the money to get television ads, and that ain't cheap. So I am very sympathetic to any new inventor and the economic challenges that they have gone through to get their idea, first off, working, and then to get it out to where somebody can actually buy it. And that is a tremendous canyon to jump over between having a good idea and when people can actually buy it. Granted, there have been some very cheap things, modifications that come across, nothing comes to mind immediately, that have enabled a few things to happen at low capital cost, but that's the exception. That's not the norm. Anything with complexity in it, anything that might be a safety hazard, you might have to get UL approval. may have to run through NREAL government agencies for confirmations on this and that. The amount of regulations that are involved in business are horrendous. And just the simple fact that, okay, you come up with a good idea, if there's any risk that that idea might explode or might harm somebody if it's not used properly, you better not release that product as a sole proprietor. You don't release it under your own name. That better be structured into a corporation to handle the liability issue. And setting up a corporation. Yeah, you can click a few buttons on the internet, and for $45 or $100 or something, yeah, you can have a corporation in another state. But do you know how to manage that? Do you know what regulations are involved? Do you know what expenses are going to be hitting you the very next day after your corporation is established? No, I do know of firms that will set up your corporation, but you wisely want to buy their training program, which usually runs $1,000 to $5,000, to be able to know just what rules and regulations are you're going to be facing to get your company started. So the general atmosphere you're going to be seeing on this program is true sympathy to the new startup inventor, and I will try to offer whatever advice I can to help the new inventor out here. But on today's show, we will be going into the history of what inventors have already done, and try to bring a level of knowledge to the audience to know that, okay, this technology has existed in the past. For some reason, they've gotten shelved or hidden, or exterminated, or whatever reason it happened to each one, that it's not really available to the public yet. And we're going to try to be going into the whys and wherefores. So I'm at across the half-hour point, and I should be getting a call in pretty shortly from James Roby from the Lexington, Kentucky Water Car Museum. Is my scheduled guest now, and he's got my call-in number. I don't see him showing up on my panel yet. Let me check my notes. Excuse me while I flip through some pages. Okay, there we go. There. All right, I'm seeing him on a control panel. Now, as we try to learn the right buttons here, we will click on and try to bring them live. Here we go. Trying to get our guest on for the day. And if we can't finish this connection, then we may have to schedule James for another day. Let me try one more. Hello, James. Are you there?
I'm here.
Okay, so you're able to hear me.
I hear you, but I don't hear you online.
Okay, there is a delay online, so at least we are both live now. I'm sorry, this control panel was a little confusing for me to use the first time, so my apologies for bringing you in late. So,
well, at least we're communicating.
Okay, we are live now. So, guest, this is James Roby from the Water Car Museum in Lexington, Kentucky, and the topic we're going to be going into is his water museum, which I guess the first question I need to ask you, James, is give listeners what your website is that explains what the preliminaries. So if anybody's listening to the program, they can jump over and at least be looking at your website.
Yeah, well, it's not much of a website. It's actually a free page from Yahoo. I've done everything on a shoestring, so
okay.
My webpage is a free starter webpage, but it's waterfuelmuseum.org or .com, either one.
Okay.
Water Fuel Museum.
Okay, good. Well, that's definitely helpful if you've at least got got your own domain rather than people who go to geocities.com/ and a whole bunch of other garbage. So
yeah.
That's good.
Well, Yahoo had a special on domains. It was like $1.99 a year. And so I went ahead and bought a domain name for every water fuel inventor that I could think of for 5 years. So it cost me $10 per inventor.
Wow.
So, and I got the same for the Water Fuel Museum. And like I said, I was doing this on a shoestring. I really couldn't afford to do this, but I couldn't help myself. I had to open a museum while it was still 2005 because
yep.
It was the 200th anniversary of the internal combustion engine automobile that ran on hydrogen.
Wow.
And I thought it was the late summer of 2005, but I had just got back from the Henry Ford Museum. They did not make mention of this vehicle in their museum. even though it was the first ICE engine vehicle that used hydrogen, it used anything. There was no internal combustion engine vehicle prior to Isaac de Rivas, or Rivas, of Switzerland. 1805 is when he had a vehicle running on hydrogen. And I just had to do it. You know, it cost me $25,000 to open and run the museum for a year.
Wow.
I didn't receive any funding from anyone. It was my wife and I working for a living. In fact, that's why I wasn't even able to tune into your program until just now, because I was repairing a floor machine.
Uh-huh.
That's what I do for a living. I do cleaning, you know.
Okay. Tell us more about your museum. What prompted you to decide to put an investment into to getting this information out, which is what basically what I'm trying to do here with this talk show, is to get information about this technology out to the public.
And I do have to commend you for your efforts, and I think you're doing an excellent thing. I know there have been other radio talk shows that included comments about energy, but they've been distorted with a lot of other stuff as well. And I have to say congratulations for this program, and I hope it lives long and prospers.
Okay, well, thank you. We're definitely going through some major technical glitches here. We had something just happen just about an hour before showtime. But at least we're on the air, and we're going to try to progress as best we can. I don't have a solid schedule set up yet, but I wanted to bring on an intelligent first guest, and so you're my first choice, since our specialty interests run in total harmony here. Tell us more on what prompted you to set up your museum.
Well, it actually goes back several years ago when the natural gas prices in the United States skyrocketed. And I had some older homes that weren't insulated well. Here in Kentucky, we get cold weather during the winter, and I just felt like it was such a ripoff that something that comes out of the ground for free should double in price, causing poor people who live in uninsulated homes to have to pay so much to these, you know, mega utility companies.
Yeah.
And, especially hearing about how some of them, like the state of California, sued the natural gas company for having ripped everybody off, and all the Enron scandals and everything. I got so sick of the energy, the mega energy companies ripping off poor people who are just trying to heat their house, you know?
Yeah.
So I decided I was going to try to find a way to heat a home without having to pay them a penny. And I thought, why not use manure or mulch? Because I remember when I was a kid, I had shoveled some cow manure for a garden, and it was terribly hot inside that pile. I mean, it was like, I think it gets to 140 degrees. And I thought, why not run a heat exchanger through a pile of manure or mulch and benefit from that heat, pass water through it, circulate it through a radiant floor heat system or some kind of radiators, and try to heat a home that way, where you're not creating any fossil fuel pollution at all. You know, and then you're actually take that mulch or manure once you've gone through a winter with it, you can spread it in your garden. So you've actually allowed it to decompose, you've benefited from the heat that it produces, and then you use it in your yard. Well, I started experimenting with that, and I had some difficulty because I was drawing out too much heat and the bacteria stopped working. So I got on the internet and started to do some searching. I'd never really heard of anyone doing this before. I thought perhaps it was my idea. But I found that there was indeed a guy in France who perfected it, and he had both heat and hot water supplied to his farm. But it takes a tremendous amount of material to do this. You can't do it with a small pile, as I had hoped. You have to have a pretty large pile to recover the heat from it and have it keep working. Otherwise, it gets like hypothermia, you know?
Yeah.
At any rate, what jumped out from the computer screen while I was doing this research is this business of there being a way to run a car on water. As I was looking up biomass and biogas and this run your car on water, I think it was the spirit of Mott, you know, the plans that they have offered on the internet for quite some time,
mm-hmm.
which plans supposedly don't work, but at least the concept got me thinking about this. And I think people had actually talked to me about a water-powered car years ago, maybe 30 years ago, when after the 73 fuel crisis, there was a lot of talk. I'm from Southern California, and so I had heard a lot of conversations about alternative energy, and I think someone had talked to me about a water-powered car, but I couldn't fathom what they were talking about, and so I just said, you know, it's nonsense. I didn't really stop and meditate on how it would work. But now I was very interested. I wouldn't let this pass without doing some research on it. So I guess you could say I got obsessed with the research of water fuel. This was the winter of 2004, 2005.
Wow, that recent.
And I spent several months. My business usually slows down that time of year anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And I just kept researching the subject, and I was very interested in finding out the particulars. And in particular, well, I went to the public library, and I looked at the books that they had on hydrogen, and I realized that these books made absolutely no mention of any of the individuals in history who have at least claimed to have made a water-powered car. None of the books in a public library talk about getting hydrogen from water. They all say it's inefficient, impossible, it's a law of diminishing returns, and so on.
Right.
And so that really, it got me going. And I just, at the same time, gas prices were skyrocketing, and, you know, people are acting like there's nothing they can do. And I'm the kind of person, I feel like a wild animal that's been caged when I'm being manipulated by someone. You know, I can't take, I've always been a rather rebellious person when it comes to submitting to authority and whatnot.
Right.
And the idea of submitting to these oil companies, ripping us off when this technology has existed all along. And at the same time, there's more and more evidence of the damage that these fossil fuels are doing to the earth. It's just, the combination just drove me to keep going. And finally, it culminated in me opening this museum.
Well, very good. So in your research then, you found that it had actually been done before. And let me interject to listeners a definition here. And I went in a little bit of this earlier of hydrogen on demand. I think both James and I each are somewhat annoyed by the flippant phrase of run your car on water, when that really has to be broken down into two aspects. Are you augmenting your existing gasoline engine with a little more hydrogen so that you're now substituting hydrogen for a portion of your fuel? So that should be best be termed as hydrogen augmentation. That is one aspect. But the true purist will come up with a system that can create enough hydrogen to run the engine entirely on water. So there's two different systems there that some uneducated people tend to flippantly use both terms as one, and they are different processes. So take it from there, James, and tell us more about the various names of people you encountered who had already accounted had already accomplished the ultimate goal of going totally on hydrogen on demand.
Well, we don't have to leave the 1800s to come up with this technology. We can stay in the 19th century. There were two water cars in particular. There were probably more, but there were at least two that are on the history books. One of them is Isaac de Rivas in Switzerland, 1805. He got his patent in 1807. And then there was Etienne Lenoir, who was Belgian, but he was living in France when he, of course, he was a famous designer of internal combustion engines, and he, like the spark plug we use today, he designed. But in 1860, he had a single-cylinder vehicle running on water from electrolysis, the hydrogen oxygen from electrolysis.
Wow.
Now, in the late 1800s, there were several inventors, in particular in the United States, that patented different systems. For instance, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I have my book here in front of me. I'm just going to open it. I constantly open it to these patents that I have actually photocopied in the book.
Yeah, I'm sorry to report FedEx did not get here yet today. So,
is that right? Yeah.
We'll refer to that topic on a future show. So continue.
Well, in particular, there is a man in the United States named Luther Wattles, and in 1897 he patented a cell that produces hydrogen that was later referenced by Francisco Pacheco. I don't know if you've ever heard of him. He was a Bolivian living in the United States when he patented a hydrogen fuel system in the 1970s. But Wattles is the first one to mention the fact that you could boost fossil fuel with hydrogen, which is what you had referred to earlier as a hydrogen augmentation or a hydrogen booster.
Right.
Wattles is the first one I can find who said, hey, if you add these gases to fossil fuel, you can use a lower grade of fuel, which would mean that you could get more out of your, you know, more bang for your buck, you know.
Uh-huh.
Following his patent in 1897, was an 1898 patent by a group of men, Eldridge, Clark, and Bloom. And they realized that if you have an arc underwater using carbon electrodes, you can produce a combustible gas efficiently. And this is basically what Ruggiero Santilli has come up with, magna gas technology, in more recent years.
Uh-huh.
His work is actually based on an 1898 patent. So here's two things from the 1800s that have been simply improved upon in the late 1900s and been presented as if it's a new technology. In fact, interestingly, Jimmy Carter, when he was president of the United States, it was his energy cabinet that hired Santilli or gave him a grant to try to find a way to get the United States out of our fossil fuel dependency. And when, you know, an Italian physicist is hired to help us out of our mess, and he finds the answer in an 1898 U.S. patent. What does that tell you?
Yeah. Well, that until the Internet happened, nobody could read old patents without hiking down to a major big city library to find it, or hiking to Washington, D.C. to comb through the actual patent office libraries there.
Yeah, we do have some advantages now. There's no question about it.
Yeah. This, in the last 5 years, this is a whole different world than we saw just 20 years ago.
Well, even our talking right now, that's a perfect example. You know, we have technology to thank for this ability to communicate about things that they would really rather us not be talking about.
Yeah, which really irritates me, just how many people want to keep their head in the sand and continuing watching the boob tube, and which is aimed entirely at a mentality that thinks that Paris Hilton and Michael Jackson is actually news.
Yeah.
Good grief, on your regular job, people, how much are you paying for a gallon of gasoline? Let's see, during the Katrina hurricanes and whatever, with the rising gas prices, I was dumping a third of my paycheck every week into my gas tank. At that time, I had a job. I just really had to drive a lot of miles. And a third of my take-home paycheck was going right into my gas tank. That's atrocious.
Yeah, it is. You know, it's actually a good thing, because if we hadn't become so angry over that ripoff, we wouldn't be talking right now. You know, it has to do with the level of pain that we're willing to endure, and they sort of blew it because they got a lot of us going in the wrong direction from their standpoint because of their greed. If they had kept the fuel prices lower, we probably would have remained complacent and not gotten involved as we had. But it's our anger over being ripped off that's actually motivated many of us to pursue alternative energy. And then the fringe benefit being that it's good for the environment.
Yeah. Well, we definitely saw the gas prices dropped a little bit before election time. And here we get off and onto the third show of the week topic of religion and politics and control, which I don't want to dig into on today's show. But getting back to major accomplishments, well, you've shocked me. I was unaware that first hydrogen car, that he was actually able to locomote down the road totally on hydrogen, that he was electrolyzing on the spot. I thought he was using stored hydrogen from another location.
Well, now, it could be. I'm not sure what Derivas was doing, but we know that he got the hydrogen from water. He may have done it chemically, and he may have done it with electrolysis. I know that he used Volta's spark device. Alessandro Volta had come out with a little, like these little, you know, piezo igniters that we have now.
Uh-huh.
Well, Alessandro Volta had come out with a little handheld, I don't know whether it was a little flint or what, but it made a spark, and that's how Derivas ignited his hydrogen.
Now, his first vehicle, I take it that was simply a one-passenger cart?
Yeah, it looked like a wagon. It was a wooden wagon. It had a vertical piston. It was quite tall. The piston, I think, or the cylinder, I'm sorry, was about, I think it was about 5 feet tall. And then it had a gear at the top with it looked like a chain that goes around. And when the 150-pound piston was forced upward by the explosion, in other words, the operator would open a valve by hand, allow the gas to go into the chamber, close the valve, ignite it by hand, the piston would be thrown upward, and as it fell, that's what would ratchet the vehicle forward.
Huh.
And so the history books write this off saying that it was unsuccessful. Well, the fact is, this vehicle had the first land speed record of an internal combustion engine vehicle a few years later. In 1813, it was given the award for the first vehicle to go 3 miles an hour.
Three?
Yeah, 3 miles an hour, which is probably
okay.
Not quite as fast as you can walk. Maybe that's why they say it was unsuccessful.
Okay. Yeah. Reason I'm asking you to bring up a few of the specifics there of the actual speed and how big his vehicle was is I can just hear the skeptics in the audience thinking, oh, that's absurd. We can't even electrolyze water fast enough today to run a car. What are you telling me? Somebody did this back in the 1800s. Well, look at the vehicle he was powering and look at the speed. Now, in today's environment, you want to power your 5 or 6 passenger family sedan down the interstate highway at 70 miles an hour, and when you're going uphill in a headwind and you've got to pass this this big old truck that's blocking you, you really need a lot of extra power. So it's two completely different worlds there.
Oh,
to be
sure.
Able, yeah, to electrolyze hydrogen fast enough to power the scenario I just explained, it's going to take a lot of hydrogen to get that much horsepower. Two different realms. But the point is that the start of this technology was done over 100 years ago, folks. What in the world has caused this to disappear in the background? Because jump ahead to, as we commented on the digital technology that's at least making this show possible, even though we got a klutzy operator here in Control Central who can't get the right button at the right time. This digital technology is equally helpful in the engineering of hydrogen on demand technology, and electronic circuits keep getting smaller and smaller and outrageously more efficient. So with the advent of the new electronics technology that's available today that was not available even 25 years ago. We are about to be seeing some amazing steps forward in this whole realm.
Oh, yeah. Well, as technology progressed through the 1900s, then more and more advanced systems for producing hydrogen on demand developed.
Mm-hmm.
And the most notable accomplishment was in 1934 when Henry Dad, as he's called, Henry Dad Garrett and his son Charles patented a water carburetor. It was the first carburetor to be installed under the hood of a vehicle. It was publicly patented, demonstrated, written up in the newspapers, and it converted the water into the hydrogen and oxygen, which was fed directly into the intake.
Hmm.
So that was a turning point there.
And what year was that again?
1934. And they had worked on the design for 8 years. That's what the newspaper articles say. So they actually began in the mid-20s, before the Depression, and then patented the thing after the Depression. The patent number on that, by the way, if someone wants to look it up, is 2,006,676. That's the U.S. patent.
Okay.
And it can be looked up quite easily on free patents online.
Okay. And the nice
thing about...
It seems
to be a superior site for retrieving patents, better than the U.S. patent system. Website.
The nice thing about the show being archived is if you didn't quite hear a number in time or the correct spelling of one of these inventors' names, you can always go back to the archives and play it over again.
Yeah, you know what's interesting to me, Ken, is that Pogue's carburetor came out the same year.
I was about to bring that up. In the early 1900s and 30s, you had two unique carburetors that dealt primarily with efficient ways of handling gasoline. That was Pogue, and then the Fish carburetor was another one.
Mm-hmm.
The Fish, as best I best my research, was able to get a car up to about 100 miles to a gallon. We're talking a 6-passenger family sedan here. The Pogue.
There's something else interesting that happened in that same period of time. I recently stumbled across a study that was done, I think it was a university professor that did this, about the use of alcohol fuels in the United States since 1900.
Uh-huh.
And he uncovered evidence of suppression by the oil companies of the use of alcohol, just as an additive, not as a replacement for gasoline, but just as an additive.
Mm-hmm.
and there was some definite interference to prevent alcohol from being introduced as a viable additive to gasoline in the early 30s. So you can imagine how they reacted to Pogue and Garrett. If they didn't want a little alcohol added to their fuel, how would they have reacted to a 200 mile per gallon carburetor or a water carburetor?
Exactly. And I know from my own personal contact experience with various inventors, there are sinister forces out there who want oil to remain as king of the hill. Well, James, I was afraid of this. We're as soon as we get going on an excellent topic here, we're coming up to the end of the show. But I think you've set a good premise here in that any future listeners who are considering, well, should I ever tune this show in again, I'm going to try to bring on the most intelligent guests that I can find, and James certainly sets a precedent here to start the show off with. But we're going to be going into to historical topics like this. So in the next 15 seconds, James, you want to cap up what you said for today's show?
Yeah, well, I would encourage people to, as you said, turn off the TV and start doing some research and some tinkering, because that's something we're losing rapidly as technology takes over our lives and corporations sell us everything we need. We lose touch with our ability to actually create products that will free us from the grip of people who would rather sell us their products.
Precisely. And I should point out, James has a book and a DVD, which I'm sorry I don't have your website in front of me here, but just
waterfuelmuseum.com or .org, either one.
Okay, and you can get more information about educational materials that he can provide from there. So, James, I want to thank you so much for being my first guest on the show.
It's a privilege. I'm very happy to participate.
Okay, I appreciate somebody who can articulate their point as well as you have. So, thank you so much. So we'll say goodbye for now. And to our listeners, we thank you so much for tuning in.